by the tree, but I haven't seen him since... Oh, there he is.
The relief was palpable in her voice. The crowd suddenly fell quiet, and then a 10-second countdown started over the tannoy, with everyone joining in. When we reached one, the tree ignited with thousands of multicoloured lights, cascading its irrepressible festive glow down on the crowd. There was a cheer and a roar, and everyone clapped. I sipped my warm, mulled wine, savouring the spark of cinnamon and cloves on my tongue, feeling a rush of happiness. As a child, I'd never had a proper family Christmas with Mum, but I always imagined this was what it should feel like. Although I was still disappointed that Michael wasn't with me, it felt right standing here in the centre of the village, with everyone pulling together for the common good. I felt like I belonged. Tansy and Ellie appeared again, waving their light wands.
"Can we have some juice, please, Mummy?"
Tansy sang out, her cheeks ruddy, eyes sparkling and bright. I poured orange juice into two paper cups. "Have you seen Alex? I think he was trying to find you both earlier." Tansy shook her head and gulped at her drink. Behind the girls, the queue was building up again. Now that the lights were on, people wanted more drinks and mince pies. It was never ending, and I seemed to be serving on average twice the number of people Donna was. She was too busy monitoring Ellie and Tansy and trying to spot her errant husband.
"Don't stray too far,"
she told the girls as they wandered off with their drinks and light wands.
"Come back every 5 minutes to check in, and whatever you do, don't leave the village green."
"Donna, they're fine. I know you live in constant fear, but they're amongst friends. Let them have a little bit of freedom." I laid a hand on her shoulder. I understood the tragedy that underpinned her concern, but I feared for Ellie's confidence, living under it 24/7.
"Easy for you to say," she muttered, glancing up at the next person in line. "What can I get you?"
The next 20 minutes passed in the blink of an eye. I didn't get a spare second as the villagers congregated around the stall, intent on getting their free drink and mince pie before proceedings wound down. But everyone was jolly, and it was pleasant to be chatting with the backdrop of the beautiful tree and the Christmas carols on repeat. Fortunately, we could see both girls from our vantage point, as they took part in a chasing game with a few other local children around the tree, so Donna relaxed a little. They were easy to spot with their day-glow light wands, but I couldn't see Alex with them, or Susie for that matter. After a while, I picked up on a restlessness in the queue of people waiting for drinks. There was a growing, audible murmur in the crowd, people looking at each other anxiously.
"What's wrong?" someone asked urgently. Then someone else said, "Who? Who's got lost?"
The music abruptly cut off, and I scanned the faces of the crowd, looking for a clue as to what the problem was. Then the tannoy burst into life again.
"Folks, we have a lost child here at the first aid station. His name is Alex, and he's wearing blue jeans and a navy puffer jacket with a red scarf. Could his mum come up here immediately to be reunited with him, please? Thank you."
"Alex?"
Donna pulled the corners of her mouth down.
"Susie's kid?"
I looked around the crowd, looking for Susie's pale pink hat. "They were here not long ago, talking to me." People started turning in the queue, talking to each other, scanning the faces in the crowd. We carried on serving for a while, and then I started to sense an air of restlessness growing around us. People were losing interest in the drinks and the lights, and their easy, relaxed movements turned into a meaningful scanning of eyes with puzzled, concerned faces. A couple of members of the parish council stopped near the stall, and I overheard their conversation.
"Can't find the mother anywhere. Plenty of people have seen her, but now it seems she's disappeared into thin air. The kid's teacher is here. She's called his mum's phone, but it's turned off."
The other man frowned.
"If she doesn't show up soon, we'll have to call off the event, just in case. We have to be seen to be taking this seriously. We'll get the police involved quite soon."
Donna's face paled.
"Oh God, it's happening again. She can't be far away,"
I said in what I hoped was a reassuring tone.
"She'll turn up in a moment, you'll see."
"That's what they said about Matilda," Donna said. staring into the dark. They said she'd be back, that she'd taken herself off somewhere, and it would all be a false alarm.
I stood on tiptoe and craned my neck. You sit down, have a coffee, Donna. Try not to panic. I poured her a drink, and she perched on a stool, looking uncomfortable. Her eyes were trained on the girls, who, sensing the drama, were sticking closer to us. After another 10 minutes, there was another announcement over the tannoy.
We regret the event is now closed. We still have Alex Barros at the first aid tent. Could his mother, Miss Susie Barros, please make her way directly to the tent to collect him? Thank you very much, everyone.
Donna stood up.
I can't just wait here. I'll take Ellie to Paul. I'm going to go help look for her.
I scanned the area again, hoping to spot Susie, who was probably frantically searching for Alex. I pulled my phone out from under the counter and called Michael.
He picked up on the second ring. Hi, Kate, I've just got here. Susie Barros is missing, I said quickly. They stopped the event early.
What?
Susie's gone missing, I said again, a little sharply. Then, sorry, it's just mayhem here. Poor Alex is on his own in the first aid tent. I'm going over there in a minute. Can you check she hasn't come back to the cottage?
Yes, of course. Hold on, I'm right near there.
I heard his footsteps scuffling, his quickening breath.
Place is in darkness, he said, knocking on the door. It's all locked up. I'll check around the back.
I heard him walking again, his breathing slightly laboured.
She hasn't just nipped to the shop or something?
I haven't spoken to anyone in charge yet. They just announced that they had Alex, who was lost at the tent, and now everyone's looking for her.
And she's just disappeared.
They can't find her anywhere, and she'd have mentioned it to Alex if she was going somewhere, I'm sure, I said. She'd never leave him alone like this.
Michael groaned. The cottage is locked up around the back too. No lights on anywhere. I think it's safe to say she isn't here.
You've got a master key for the cottages, haven't you? Can't you check inside?
He hesitated. Not really. Not without a good reason.
Like the fact she's gone missing, you mean?
It's an invasion of privacy, Kate. Unless the police ask me to.
Well, that might not be very long. I ended the call, irritated, then walked around the stall, out into the crowd. Donna appeared again, a worried expression on her face.
There's no sign of her, she said, a little breathlessly. I've just been over to the first aid station. Paul's in there, and the kid, Alex, he's just sitting there, staring into space, wouldn't say a word to me.
I untied my apron and dumped it on the table. I'll go and see if he's okay. You stay here with the girls.
Donna nodded, not taking her eyes from Ellie, who was still with Tansy, waving their lightsabers near the tree. I walked off towards the first aid station. A group of teenagers ran by, pushing into people and laughing, high on adrenaline, oblivious to the concern all the adults were feeling. When I reached the small tent, Paul was standing inside like a sentry on guard.
He's okay, he said curtly, obviously displeased to see me. Best not to make a fuss, in my opinion.
Alex looked smaller, as if he'd folded in on himself. He clutched his light wand like his life depended on it. When he saw me, someone he recognised, relief flooded his face.
Hi, Alex. Are you okay, love?
I crouched down next to him and slid my arm around his shoulders. They're looking for your mum now. I'm sure she'll be back very soon. He sniffed, rubbing at his already sore eyes.
Where has she gone?
That's what we're trying to find out. We're checking that she hasn't gone back home or something. Did she not say she was popping off somewhere? He shook his head.
Where were you when you last saw her?
He pointed to the edge of the green.
We were standing there, and I wanted to be closer to the Christmas tree when the lights turned on, so I ran over there, and when I came back, she was gone.
We've asked him all this, Kate.
Paul frowned.
This'll just stress him out more.
I ignored him.
Did you see your mum speak to anyone before she got lost, Alex?
He thought for a moment and looked at Paul.
I can't remember, he said, dropping his head. I only wanted to see the tree.
It's all right, Alex, Paul said pointedly. You're not in any trouble.
Of course he's not in trouble.
Maybe you should stop questioning him like he is then.
I shot Paul a withering look before turning back to Alex.
Don't worry. I'm sure your mummy will be back here soon. I'll sit with you until she gets here. Would you like that?
There's no need, Paul objected. I can...
Yes, Alex said, looking relieved. I'd like you to stay, Kate.
A couple of hours later, the village green was swarming with police. Michael had now returned and had hastily put together a search team.
I checked the cottage again before I left, but it's still locked up and in darkness, he told me. She's definitely not there.
The police had set up a small inquiry tent on the green, and officers were moving around and speaking to people, asking anyone who'd seen Susie at the event to report what they remembered. I kept thinking about Susie's cryptic comments about why she'd left Poland and her nervous manner. It was hard to explain it to someone else. It had just been my take on it. I hoped she was okay and not in any danger. I didn't know her well, but I felt convinced that she wouldn't leave Alex behind, whatever the reason might be. A group of uniformed officers walked by, and I overheard that they were heading for the woodland that skirted the edge of the village. This is starting to feel really serious, I said to Michael when he came over.
Hopefully she'll turn up, he said. The police want me to take them up to her cottage before we start the search around the village. I'll call you if we find her.
When I got back to the first aid tent, a couple of women were standing with Alex. He turned and said something to one of them.
We're from social services, she said, holding up her ID lanyard. I know Alex is new to the village, and a gentleman called Paul Thatcher said he and his wife were happy to take him in tonight, but Alex tells us he knows you and someone called Irene?
Yes, Irene Wadebridge is their landlady. I moved closer. Are you okay, Alex? His dark eyes looked up at me, and I could see flecks of panic sparking in them.
I don't want to go with Paul or those ladies, he said quickly, tapping his fingers on his leg. I want to stay here with you until they find my mummy.
I turned to the social worker. I'm happy to take him home with me tonight until things are sorted, I said. I work at the school, so I have all the appropriate safeguarding checks. You can speak to the head teacher if you need to. She took a phone out of her handbag. It's kind of you to offer, she said. Let me make a couple of calls and see if I can get that approved. I sat down next to Alex. Don't worry, I said. Everything will be okay. But I had an uneasy feeling stirring in my gut. I sat with Alex and the girls while the social workers made their calls. Donna kept the drink stall open for the benefit of the large search team, but she closed up eventually because of getting Ellie home. She came over to say goodbye, and I stood up and moved away from the kids to speak to her. He's coming back with us, I said.
What?
Just for tonight, until they locate Susie. I couldn't see social services take him, and it was kind of you and Paul to offer, but he's so upset and he knows us a bit better.
We haven't offered to have him.
Donna frowned. Well, the lady from social services said Paul had offered, I explained, which was good of him.
Just Paul.
But poor lad, I feel for him, Donna said. Well done you for volunteering to have him, Kate. He knows you all well, she hesitated. But have you thought what's going to happen if they don't find Susie tonight? Or tomorrow?
I shrugged off her comment. I felt confident Susie would turn up, having had some sort of crisis that had prevented her from getting back to Alex.
Later, at home, I found Alex some red Christmas pyjamas someone had bought for Tansy last year that were still a bit too big. I made Tansy and Alex some hot chocolate and got them ready for bed. They were both exhausted. I was so busy fending off Tansy's whining about the pyjamas she wanted to wear and the biscuit she wanted with her drink, I didn't think anything of Alex's quietness. Then I looked at him and saw tears streaming silently down his face.
Oh, sweetheart, come here.
He resisted at first, then he sort of melted into my side. Tansy's eyes were wide and startled.
What's wrong with him, Mummy?
She said fearfully. He's sad, Tansy.
the way you'd be sad if I got lost. She crept to the other side of me and huddled in.
It's okay, Alex, she said. You can stay here with us until your mum gets home.
We sat like that a while, then went upstairs. I'll be in very soon, I told Tansy, and took Alex into the spare room where I tucked him in tightly.
I want Wojtek, he sniffed, starting to cry again.
Who?
Wojtek, my teddy bear.
I promise we'll get him for you tomorrow. Michael can pick you some stuff up from the cottage. But tonight, we all need to get some sleep, okay? Tomorrow is a new day. He nodded sadly and closed his eyes.
Don't worry, Alex, I whispered as I kissed his forehead. We'll find her.
Afterwards, I went to Tansy's bedroom. We stood at her window and watched the torches flitting around like lit matches in the fields that framed the outskirts of the village.
Nobody's giving up, I said. Your daddy is out there looking for Alex's mummy with lots of other people. But what do you think has happened to her?
Tansy said in a small voice.
Where has she gone?
I don't know, sweetie, I said carefully. But if anyone can find her, Daddy can. She nodded, looking reassured. I tucked her into bed and went back downstairs. I'd started to doze on the sofa when Michael texted me at 11 p.m. We're calling it a day. No sign of her anywhere. I put down the phone and sighed, my heart heavy when I thought about the distraught little boy upstairs. How could anyone just disappear into thin air in a village where everyone knew each other? It didn't make any sense at all.
Chapter 13. Michael got home just before midnight.
Jeez, what a night.
He looked dog-tired, heavy shadows under his eyes, his body still sprung with tension. Alex is asleep in the spare room, I said, as I pulled myself off the sofa to make him a hot drink.
What?
Michael looked up from unlacing his boots. Yeah, I offered to have him because we're just about the only people he knows well. Paul offered, but Alex wanted to come here. That's okay, isn't it? He stared at me, and I felt moved to defend myself further. I was worried about him, Michael.
I'm worried about him too, but, well, I can't help wondering if he'd be better off with professionals looking after him.
Social services, you mean? I said, horrified.
No, well, maybe. It's just that they'd know what to say to him. While his mum's missing, I mean.
I know I'd want someone from the village to look after Tansy if I went missing, I said, dropping a tea bag into a mug. Someone she knew.
I know, and you're right. Michael went back to unlacing his boots. It's just that there's no sign of Susie, and now we've got the boy here.
Alex, I poured on boiling water and got milk from the fridge.
Yes, we've got Alex here, and that adds pressure because it means we're right in the centre of it all, whether we want to be or not.
I took a teaspoon and sloshed the tea around a little too vigorously. Dark brown liquid splashed over the lip of the cup onto the worktop. I did what I thought was right, Michael. I didn't think about the inconvenience to us if Susie wasn't found right away. I plonked the mug down unceremoniously on the table in front of him.
Don't be like this, Kate.
Like what? You're the one being unreasonable. Is giving temporary shelter to a distressed child really one step too far? Even Paul found it in his heart to offer. I knew I was being unfair. He was clearly shattered, but the words were out before I could stop.
We hardly know them, that's all I'm saying.
And we need to think about the effect all this is going to have on Tansy. Teaching her kindness to others, you mean?
Look, I've got something to tell you.
His face sagged.
They searched Susie's cottage and found my keys on her kitchen worktop.
Your keys? He nodded.
My second work set for the mower, the storage shed, the gates, stuff like that.
What was he saying?
Why were your keys in Susie's cottage?
My voice emerged thin and strained. He looked away.
It sounds stupid, but I don't know.
My breathing quickened, panic squeezing at my throat. Are you trying to tell me you've been there with her? Is this a confession?
Oh, God, no. I honestly don't know how the keys got in there, Kate. You have to believe me.
If your keys are in there, you must have left them, I said quietly.
No, I haven't been in the cottage since I repaired the tap earlier in the week, and I've used the keys after that.
You told the police this?
Yes, but...
He dropped his head into his hands.
I could tell they didn't believe me. I wanted to let you know in case they speak to you and it comes out.
He looked up.
I wanted to be the one to tell you. I want you to know.
It sounds like you're covering yourself, I said quietly. My hands were tingling.
No, Kate.
He stood up and moved over to me, grasping my fingers.
If I'd gone in there alone and found the keys myself, I'd still have told you, because it doesn't make sense.
What did the police say about it?
Well, they were surprised, I think. But I told them the same as you. I didn't know how they'd got there.
Frustrated, he blew out air.
It's the truth, I swear.
A quiet fury began to seep into my chest. You know Susie much better than you let on, don't you?
What? No, I don't know her well at all.
The breaks you took together, the cosy little afternoon teas, you damn well do. My outburst was ill-timed, but still, he should have told me this stuff before. He raised his hand in a sign for me to calm down, which only infuriated me more.
I mean, yeah, I see her up at Wadebridge sometimes, and Irene asked her to call some suppliers for me, but I don't know her as such.
His cheeks coloured up slightly. We were going around in circles, but I was in a dilemma. I'd known Michael 17 years now, and he wasn't a liar. He valued the truth, always had, which was why none of it made any sense. Michael, I don't know what to think. All I know is that Susie is missing, her son is distraught, and now the police probably think you have something to do with it.
I swear to God, I don't know where she is, Kate.
He looked at me from panicky eyes.
But one thing I do know is that it's not good news they can't find her with such a comprehensive search. I mean, where could she be?
The awful possibilities silenced me for a moment.
Kate, please, we're okay, aren't we? We'll get through this.
I felt puzzled about the keys, suspicious and scared about what it might mean. I felt these things all at once, the emotion bearing down on me like a steam press. I said, I'm going up to check on the kids, and walked out. After I'd checked on Tansy, I looked in on Alex in the spare room. He was fast asleep, his straight, fine, dark hair brushed off his smooth forehead, his eyelids fluttering as if he was caught in a dream. I felt a pull inside. He shouldn't have to experience this kind of fear and loss at such a young age. If only he had a father we could contact, but from the little Susie had said on the matter, he was probably the reason they'd left Poland in the first place. And then I felt that same tightening inside again, the sharp clutch of loneliness and fear that came from being young and scared and on your own. That feeling that you weren't safe, and it was only a matter of time before your life blew up. I'd promised myself my own daughter would never feel that way. All I could do was hope the police believed Michael's plea about the keys, even though I was having problems believing him myself.
Chapter 14, 11th of November, 2019. The next morning, I was woken at 6:30 by Michael's phone pinging with a text. It was Irene, to say there was a heavy police presence up at Wadebridge, and could he possibly come in early? I left him getting his work stuff together and went into the bathroom. I had a quick wash at the sink and splashed cold water on my face. I'd shower later, but for now,
I didn't want to disturb the kids with the noisy hot water tank. Downstairs, I was surprised to find Tansy and Alex already up and in the living room, sitting together in front of the television, sharing the warmth of a fleecy blanket. Tansy looked up at me.
Alex woke up and he'd had a nasty dream about his mummy, didn't you, Alex?
He nodded forlornly.
So I brought him down to watch television.
That was a good idea, sweetie, I said. I wondered how she'd got so grown up so quickly. How are you feeling, Alex?
Have they found my mum yet?
He said. Not yet, but we're hoping there might be some news today. I leaned forward and squeezed his shoulder. Now, who'd like some toast and juice? I had to try and keep his spirits up without blindly telling him everything was going to be okay, because I didn't know that. Nobody knew that yet. At 7 o'clock, there was a knock at the door. A quick glance through the spy hole revealed two uniformed police officers on the doorstep. I glanced back into the living room to ensure the kids were still distracted by the television, and then opened the door.
Sorry to disturb you so early, madam, one of the officers said. We're conducting door-to-door inquiries, following the disappearance of a young woman yesterday. Can we ask you...
I have her son here,
I hissed, checking over my shoulder before turning back to him.
I have Susie Barros's son staying here, and I wouldn't want him to overhear any details.
Oh, I see,
the officer faltered.
Everything okay?
Michael came downstairs, dressed in his work gear. They want to ask us some questions about Susie, but I'm worried about it upsetting Alex, I told him. A picture filled my mind. The knock on the door all those years ago when I was a kid. The police officer standing there, and me, hiding behind the sofa, terrified what they were about to tell me about where Mum had been for the past week. Me lying about her drinking and her finding the car keys I'd hidden. Feeling responsible for everything bad that happened as a result of that.
Come through to the kitchen, Michael said to the officers. We can close the door while we talk.
He squeezed my hand.
Do you want to check on the kids, Kate, and I'll take the officers through?
I nodded, grateful for Michael thinking on his feet. I closed the front door, then went back into the living room. Tansy was munching on her toast, her gaze glued to the TV. But Alex was pushing his breakfast around his plate, his eyes glazed and unfocused.
I need you two to stay in here for a little while, okay?
I said as casually as I could, but Tansy was sharp as a knife.
Why? Who came to the door, Mummy?
Police officers, I said. They need to speak with me and your dad, so stay in here, please.
Is it about my mum?
Alex looked up, his expression landing somewhere between hope and fright.
Have they found her?
Not yet, Alex, but they're asking lots of questions and finding out lots of important information that we hope will help find her. Wordlessly, he turned back to the television. I blew a kiss to Tansy and closed the door. Then I walked into the kitchen, closing that door behind me too. Chapter 15. The officers were both male, one tall and thin in his late 20s, the other about 10 years older and on the portly side.
I'm PC Turner, and this is PC Jenkins, the tall one said, flashing ID.
Can I get you both some tea? I asked, thinking Michael probably hadn't thought to offer.
Thank you, but no,
Turner said briskly, earning himself a scowl from his colleague.
We have a lot of houses to cover.
We all sat down at the table, and Jenkins pulled out a notebook and pen.
Now, I'm assuming that if you have Susie Barros's son staying here, you know her well?
Michael looked over at me. Not really. Her son is in my daughter's class, and Susie has been over here for a coffee. We're not best friends or anything. I've been trying to get to know her a bit better.
Trying?
She's quite a private person, I said carefully. I think she finds it difficult to open up to people.
Why do you think that might be?
I hesitated. Should I tell them that she'd hinted that she'd come over to England to escape problems in Poland? This wasn't the time to keep information back.
I got the impression Susie was unhappy for various reasons at home in Poland.
Really? What did she say to make you think that?
She said she was hoping to make a fresh start, leave her problems behind.
What sort of problems?
The other officer asked. She didn't say.
Susie lives in one of the Wadebridge cottages. She's Irene's home help, Michael said suddenly. I'm Irene Wadebridge's property and land manager, so I'm up there every day.
I noticed a clear gear change from both officers. They sat up a little straighter, shuffled to the edge of their seats as they made the link.
You helped organise the search last night, one of them said. Your keys were found in Miss Barris's cottage.
Yes, Michael said carefully. As I explained to the officers at the time, she must have found them lying around the site and took them in for me.
And how long have you worked for Irene Wadebridge, sir?
10 years in my current position, Michael said easily, but I worked with her late husband for 10 years before that.
I see. Can I ask what your duties are?
Jenkins said, scribbling away.
A bit of everything, really. A full range of duties connected to the cottages and land. I take care of the small maintenance jobs, but if there's bigger stuff needs doing, I'll get the necessary quotes and use local companies if I can. I cut the grass, but we have a gardening company for the planting and weeding.
Turner said, So I take it you must also know Susie Barros personally, Mr. Shaw? Michael glanced at me.
Like I said, she's a tenant in one of the cottages.
Does that involve you having contact with her on a daily basis?
Not every day, but inevitably there have been occasions when we've spoken.
Michael sounded polite, but I detected a slight irritation.
Could you give us some examples of your recent contact with Miss Barros, sir?
Jenkins said, writing something down. Also, exactly when you last saw her, Turner added, rather curtly. I swallowed. This was starting to sound like proper police questioning. Was this the point where we should ask if Michael needed a lawyer? I was getting the uncomfortable feeling of being the last person to know what had been happening. I clasped my hands together and sat forward.
Nothing to worry about, Mrs. Shaw,
Jenkins murmured, noticing my tense manner.
This is all part of the door-to-door, just routine inquiries.
Michael gave me a quick nod to show he was okay with it, and I sat back.
Let's see.
He looked up at the ceiling while he organised his thoughts.
I saw her a couple of times last week, just to wave hello to while I was out and about.
An image of Susie in her tight jeans and high boots flitted unhelpfully in and out of my head. I was at her cottage last Monday afternoon to fit a new washer on the kitchen tap.
And how long would you say you were in there, sir?
Michael pulled down the edges of his mouth. No more than half an hour. It was a straightforward job.
And did you have a chat with Miss Barros while you were there?
We passed the time of day, he said, a little stilted.
She made me a drink.
I felt a now familiar stab of discomfort. He'd mentioned the tap, but not the fact he'd spent half an hour with Susie in her cottage that day. On top of that, Michael had clearly decided not to tell the police about their cosy afternoon cuppers and the fact she'd been ringing suppliers, and no doubt relaying that information to him. If I was a cynical sort, I might think he was feeding various people, including me, different stories depending what suited him. And while you were attending the repair, Turner ventured, did Miss Barros say anything that led you to believe she was thinking of taking off anywhere?
No, he said quickly. If that were the case, I would have spoken up last night, instead of helping to organise a full-scale search until nearly midnight.
Jenkins ignored Michael's swipe.
You were on the village green last night with everyone else.
Michael nodded. I didn't see her at the Christmas event last night. I was busy with the organisation of it. No mention of leaving early to go up to Wadebridge. I felt my throat tighten.
Fine. I've got all that down, thank you,
Jenkins said, tapping his notepad. He turned to me.
Same question for you, please, Mrs. Shaw. Apart from last night, when was the last time you saw Susie?
Alex came over to play after school recently. Susie picked him up, but she didn't stay. She had to shoot off to do something or other, I forget what.
I was running the drink stall at the Christmas event last night, and she came by to ask if my daughter would like a play date next week up at the cottage.
What time would that have been?
I thought for a moment. It was before the lights were turned on at 6. I'd say maybe 15 minutes before that.
And you and Mr. Shaw were together all night apart from the search?
Well, Michael was round and about doing stuff for the event, and I was running the drink stall, but yes, we were there all the time apart from... My words petered out.
Apart from...
Jenkins echoed, looking from me to Michael. I'd slipped up.
I had to leave just before the lights were turned on, Michael said, as if it were no big deal. Irene Wadebridge rang me to say her downstairs loo was leaking.
I see, Turner said, his eyes narrowing. So at the point when Susie Barros's absence was discovered, you'd already left the event, sir?
Yes.
What time did you arrive at Wadebridge? Michael thought for a moment.
About 6:30. It took me slightly longer because I had to call at home for some of my tools. Mrs. Wadebridge will be able to vouch for my movements.
I didn't look at him. He'd never mentioned popping home before going up to Wadebridge. And as far as I knew, he kept his tools in the cottage or his van. The officers asked a few more general details about village life, the number of events there'd been in the last month and such like.
Thank you both very much for your input. Someone will be in touch if we need to follow up, Turner said to Michael as they left.
We stood in the hallway for a minute or two.
Christ, that was a bit heavy.
Michael blew out air and pinched the bridge of his nose. His face looked damp and hot.
You dropped me in it at the end when you mentioned that I'd had to leave. Made it sound like I'd purposely not told them.
I said it without thinking, but why didn't you tell them that yourself?
It slipped my mind. So much was happening last night.
I can't see how you forgot that Irene summoned you about the leaking toilet. You never mentioned you'd hung around talking to Susie on Monday after fixing the tap either, I said, trying and failing to keep the accusation out of my voice.
I didn't spend time there as such. I was mending a tap, that was all.
He threw up his hands. I must do half a dozen repairs a week on the cottages, and I wouldn't dream of boring you with those either. I know, but Irene reckons she's sweet on you.
Oh, come on, Kate. Irene's got nothing better to do with her time than make up silly stories.
Easy to try and discount Irene's opinion, but we both knew it was the fact that Susie was a young, attractive woman that was making me so annoyed. I tried to avoid sounding jealous and petty, but it wasn't easy. It gave me a small insight into how Donna must feel about Paul. With Susie being new to the village and keeping herself to herself, I thought you might have found out something interesting, that's all. I'd told you she seemed nervy about something or someone.
It was just a how-you-settling-in type of chat. Nothing deep and meaningful to report, Kate, or I'd have told you. You know that.
He draped his forearms over my shoulders.
You are a silly goose at times.
I felt myself bristle. Michael could defend himself all he liked, but Susie had gone missing last night, leaving our sleepy little village in shock. Anyone else might have thought it a good idea to mention to their wife that they'd spent time at her cottage a few days earlier. I wasn't the only one surprised at the revelation. The police had seemed taken aback too. I didn't know you'd come home before going up to Wadebridge, I said. What tools had you left here?
I thought I'd left my blue toolbox in the porch, but I checked and it wasn't there. When I went back to the van, I saw it was in there after all, hidden by a dust sheet.
He pulled at his bottom lip.
Have you ever thought about joining the police, Kate? You're starting to sound like them.
I rolled my eyes. I'm going to keep Tansy and Alex off school today, I said, feeling relieved that there was a simple explanation about the tools. There's no way Alex is going to be able to concentrate on his schoolwork, and it won't do Tansy any harm to keep him company until Susie is found. Michael pursed his lips.
Sounds like an executive decision has been made.
He gave a wan smile. I'd better get over to Wadebridge. Irene will want a full report on what's happening. It'll kill her that she's missing all the drama because of her sciatica. She's usually the first to arrive at a village event.
Michael,
We're not talking about the village fate here. A woman is missing, and I get the feeling you should be worried about that more than most.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, you work where she lives, and the police are already curious about how your keys came to be in her cottage. You didn't even tell them about your afternoon chats and the fact she'd been helping with suppliers. You're right about one thing. This is big drama. Unfortunately, you're right at the centre of it.
He looked at me, a strange expression on his face. I thought for a moment he was going to say something, but he shook his head, almost to himself, and turned away.
He popped through to say goodbye to Tansy and Alex, then kissed me on the cheek before he left.
"Have some faith in me, Kate," he said softly. "I need you to totally believe in me, because if you don't, why will anyone else?"
"That sounds a bit cryptic," I said, my mouth suddenly dry. "What are you trying to say?"
"Nothing."
He smoothed a few stray ponytail hairs from my cheek.
"Just that I need your support while the police are up at Wadebridge sniffing around. It's stressful, that's what I'm saying. The way they try and make more of things. Do you understand?"
I nodded, but I wasn't sure I did. Not really. Michael left the house smiling, but underneath the surface, I could feel a new, unresolved tension sitting between us. The man who came home to give me flowers, and who'd been so attentive lately, seemed a million miles away right now. I really wanted that man back.
Chapter 16. Irene Wadebridge stared out of the front room window at the beech hedge Amos had planted all those years ago to give them some privacy from the cottage tenants. The copper leaves turned and twisted in the wind as if they were trying to work their way loose. The cottages had been built for mill workers in the 19th century and were sturdy but cold, no matter what the season. Several had developed damp problems, and Michael had devised a rolling remedial program he continued to work on. There had been a whirlwind of activity up at Wadebridge all morning. Police and forensic officers had been on site since the early hours, and Irene understood that door-to-door inquiries were being carried out back in the village. She'd had to allow them full access to Susie's home and the surrounding grounds, too. It was like something on the telly. Numerous police officers and other officials had wanted to speak with her. Irene had taken her involvement as the owner of Susie's cottage very seriously indeed. The efficient senior officer, a DI Helena Price, had explained that there was a clear and rigorous procedure that must be worked through, and that Irene was an important part of it. Using her walking frame, which got her around the kitchen slowly but safely, she had made the officers countless cups of tea and coffee, and had lined water and juice up on the worktop for anyone who wanted a cold drink. It wasn't easy with her arthritis, not to mention the painful sciatica that flared up with alarming regularity, both conditions she'd never had while Amos had been alive, but she hadn't minded doing it. It was reassuring to be able to contribute, even in this small way, to the process of finding out exactly what had happened to that poor girl. The village had only recovered in recent years from the disappearance of the schoolgirl, Matilda, so she wasn't surprised when Michael told her the villagers were in a quandary to have another unexplained vanishing occur in such a small place. The uniformed officers, who all looked to Irene as if they had just left school, were a friendly bunch. They seemed very grateful for the refreshments and to be allowed the use of a cottage bathroom. Sadly, their efforts had so far drawn a blank, and D.I. Price explained that everyone would decamp back to the station to regroup and strategize, which Irene thought sounded rather impressive. She stared out over the hedge toward the cottages. Amos would be turning in his grave at the thought of something untoward happening in dwellings owned by his family for generations. There were no holidaymakers at this time of year, although she had taken a couple of bookings over the Christmas period. The place felt quiet and empty without all the police activity,
and she was already missing the unofficial updates the grateful officers had given her when they came in to get their drinks. Still, Michael was here again now. He'd looked weary, and had explained that Kate had taken young Alex in for the night, which Irene thought admirable.
"She's keeping Tansy and Alex off school today," he'd added. "I know it's hard on the boy, but I would have thought it best to keep things as normal as possible."
When Michael confided in her like this, Irene felt a warm glow spread through her chest.
"I mean, we don't know where Susie is."
He looked out of the window at the fields beyond.
"Who knows how long it might take to locate her?"
There were a few moments of silence until Irene, who hadn't got any children, said,
"In my experience, once you start keeping little ones at home, it's very difficult to convince them to go back to school."
Michael gave a grunt of agreement. His phone rang, and he moved outside to take the call. Irene stood up. Predictably, her bones protested. She supported herself by holding onto the windowsill, from where she had a clear view of the end cottage that Susie rented. She had started as just another home help from the agency Irene had used for years, but had swiftly proved she was the best one. She'd jumped at the opportunity of a full-time position when Irene offered her a direct job, and had resigned from the agency, telling them she was moving out of the area. When Susie told Irene about the cramped B&B they were living in, she'd offered her the cottage. Susie had signed a 12-month contract and moved in 5 months ago. Irene had already got used to having her and Alex around. For a young woman, Susie was surprisingly insular. For the first couple of weeks of her tenancy, Irene had seen little of her or the boy when she was off duty. Then she'd invited them over for a cup of tea and a piece of cake, and that had been the start of the two of them popping over to the house more regularly. When Susie had an appointment in town one weekend, Irene played board games with Alex for a couple of hours, and it had gone on from there. Susie would pop into town to the supermarket to do her shopping and take a list of a few things Irene needed herself, and if it happened to be the school holidays or out of school hours, Irene would watch Alex. It soon became clear to Irene when she saw the cheap white bread and endless tins of beans nestled amongst her own organic chicken, prawns and branded goods, that the young woman had scarce funds. But she was a proud girl, and she'd already told Irene that her mother had raised her to be frugal and hard-working, and Irene had admired her staunch spirit. Susie seemed interested in Wadebridge and how things ran here. Irene enjoyed taking her through the mechanics of the place and the history of those who had worked there. She always got the impression that lots of the villagers assumed she didn't have an overview because she wasn't a hands-on owner. But they were mistaken. She'd wager there wasn't a thing happened up here that she wasn't aware of. She even dealt with the online bookings in the summer months. She might have just turned 75, but she still had her wits about her, even if her body was letting her down. 3 weeks ago, she had asked Susie if she had the time to help her sort out her overstuffed wardrobes and the half-dozen old suitcases packed with clothes that were taking up space. Kate was always badgering her to do so, but she wanted to feel in charge of her own possessions. Kate would have loved her old clothes bundled in black bin bags and be heading to the dustbin with them before Irene had a chance to consider each garment carefully.
"Of course," Susie had said without a second thought, "it is my pleasure to help you."
Irene had asked Michael to bring down the dusty old suitcases from the attic, and Susie had made a start while Alex was happy in front of the TV with the Marvel colouring book, crayons, and snacks Irene had provided. Upstairs, Susie had oohed and aahed when she'd set eyes on Irene's old Bieber pieces. Some garments hadn't seen the light of day for 50 years, when Irene had been in her early 20s and had been quite the girl around town. Susie's eyes were popping.
"This clothing is classed as vintage now, Irene. Did you know you can sell them for good money on eBay?"
Irene had laughed.
"Goodness, I knew I was getting on a bit, but vintage? That makes me sound really past it."
Susie had been mortified, her hand flying up to her mouth.
"Oh, I didn't mean to upset you, Irene. I'm so sorry. Vintage is a fashion term, you see, and...
I know. I was just joking, dear girl.
Irene reassured her, realizing that her cheeky sense of humor had somehow got lost in translation. Susie's pretty features relaxed then, and Irene had insisted she pick a couple of pieces for herself. She tried on a skimpy gold knitted top with her jeans and a pair of chunky platform shoes that Amos had branded clodhoppers and that Irene could only remember wearing once. Michael had popped in looking for his keys, and oh, Irene had watched his face when Susie walked in all dressed up like that. It had given the term eyes on stalks a whole new meaning. Still, in Susie and Michael, Irene knew she'd struck gold. Michael kept the cottages maintained and organized the landscaping of the gardens and surrounding fields. He'd come over late on Christmas Eve last year when the boiler had gone out, and he was familiar with all the stringent health and safety and legal requirements. He was crucial to the management of the place, and although Irene would never tell him as much, he probably did the work of three or four people. It was an arrangement that worked well, seeming to suit Michael as much as herself, and she made up her mind that she'd protect it at all costs. Chapter 17, Spring 2012. Jakob. When the plane landed at Stansted Airport, Jakob walked down the aircraft steps, zipping up his fleece against the biting wind. If this was a taste of England's spring, he had better adjust his expectations. Jakob prided himself on his internet research skills. He had joined an online forum where he'd found a plethora of advice from Polish nationals who had successfully made new lives for themselves in England. Using this excellent resource, he'd already established a couple of useful contacts, one of them a man who came from the next town to Zalipie. He'd told Jakub there were established Polish communities in the East Midlands area and had given him a couple of places that were large employers of casual labour. Jakub had heard the rumours of Polish girls at these places, many of them friendly and looking to make a connection with a boy from the motherland. He could usually spot a Polish girl before she opened her mouth. There had been a few on the plane. The way they looked, their style, that unspoken way they seemed to recognise his nationality too. He'd tried to ignore the twist of fury that shot through him at the flirtatious glances, the fact that they were here and wanted him, but Anna was back home in the arms of another man. He had nowhere to put the anger, so he swallowed it down. He had pre-booked a National Express coach ticket from Stansted to Nottingham, with one change at Leicester. After a never-ending wait in passport control, he boarded the coach and braced himself for the 4.5-hour journey. To Jakub, this journey represented the start of him making his fortune and winning back Anna. Something had happened inside him, like a switch flipping since Anna had left him for Oscar. It had loosened him up. Nothing much mattered anymore, and it had made him feel a little dangerous. Women seemed to pick up on that. There had been a couple of girls since Anna. None of them had come anywhere close to her, of course. Jakub had found a new attraction to more unavailable girls, the ones who weren't looking for a man, or who actively discouraged his interest. It was a little screwed up, he knew, but he didn't care. He didn't care about anything but getting Anna back. He dreamed about her day and night, and she took up every minute of each waking hour. He was a man obsessed, and there was nothing he could do about it. The Holly's bed and breakfast accommodation he'd booked online for the first week was located in a market town called Sutton-in-Ashfield, which was conveniently located about 12 miles north of the city of Nottingham. The place was basic but clean. He shared a large room with another Polish national, an older man called Ludwig, who had no family and who lived in the north of the country. Jakub showed him the two factories that had been recommended online, and Ludwig had screwed up his face.
"These are okay if you want to breathe in stale air while you work 16-hour days," he said scathingly. "No windows, few breaks. You might as well be in prison, yes?"
Jakub grimaced. This wasn't the picture he'd painted in his head of his new life in England.
I heard they have strict laws here about the number of hours one can work.
Ludwig laughed.
On paper, for the benefit of the health and safety inspectors, of course. In reality, it is a different story, my friend. Unofficially, they will offer you twice the working hours, with the extra paid at a much lower hourly rate but in cash. Nobody likes this, but everyone does it for the money.
If there is no choice in the matter, then that is what I must accept to make a start.
If you want my advice, find a small farm that is hiring. Also, long hours and hard work. But anyone who likes fresh air and a sense of freedom would just wither away and die in one of those god-awful factories.
Ludwig chewed the inside of his cheek.
I am hoping for a good opportunity myself soon. I can feel my luck changing, and soon I will leave this house and get my own place. You should do the same.
Ignoring the advice he'd been given, the next day, Jakob went to the first prospective employer on his list, a packaging factory that had numerous mentions on the forums as a place that always needed cheap, casual labour. When he got off the bus, he had to walk for miles to the sprawling concrete building in the middle of nowhere. His thin t-shirt and frayed denim jacket offered little protection against the biting wind, and his worn leather shoes finally gave up the ghost when the heel came detached from the upper, letting in damp and grit and flopping about as he walked. He followed the signs to reception and registered his details before sitting in one of the screwed-down plastic seats, his sock sopping and uncomfortable. There were three other young Polish men in the waiting room, but they didn't acknowledge each other. They sat in silence for 20 minutes until a disinterested middle-aged man called them through together and gave them a short tour around the shop floor. Jakob stood aghast for a moment when they first entered the factory. The noise of machinery assailed his ears, making it difficult for him to think straight. So many bodies busy working, lifting boxes, loading assembly lines, no time for chatting or even noticing that anyone had entered their working area. He could not see the other side of the room, so vast was the space. His eyes gravitated to the walls. No windows, just like Ludwig had predicted. He breathed in the warm, electrically charged air and made his excuses. Working from dawn to dusk in a place like this would kill him. Kill the hope he had inside of making his fortune and winning back Anna. That hope was all he had in life, and he knew instinctively that he had to keep it alive at all costs. Otherwise, he might as well be dead. He would go back to the B&B and research the area, and tomorrow he would take his chances with finding work as a labourer on a farm, as his knowledgeable roommate had suggested. Chapter 18, 11th of November, 2019. Nottinghamshire Police. The Devonshire B&B was a tired-looking three-storey semi on a run-down street near the centre of town. Helena noted a peeling sign in the front window announcing vacancies and another next to it that boasted shared rooms available.
A shared room in a B&B? Brewster grimaced. Wouldn't fancy that.
I suppose some folks don't get a choice, Helena remarked. Brewster tried the front door, but it was locked.
Sign of the times, he murmured.
He rang the bell. A large man in his early 30s with greasy brown hair came to the door. He wore a Star Wars t-shirt and baggy jeans that tucked under a protruding belly. His mouth was full of something that caused escaping crumbs to tumble onto his chin. He didn't speak, but continued chewing and raised his eyebrows at them instead. Brewster flashed his ID.
D.I. Price and D.S. Brewster, Nottinghamshire Police, he said briskly. We'd like to speak to the owner of the establishment, please.
The man continued to chew. Eventually, he swallowed, wiped his mouth with the back of a large, pale hand, and said,
That'll be my sister, Pat. She's out shopping.
How long's she likely to be? Brewster asked. Who knows? I reckon it'll be too long for you to sit and wait.
Perhaps you could call her, ask her to return, he suggested.
Nah. She ain't got a phone, has she?
Reckons they rot your brain.
The man laughed, displaying teeth that were badly in need of dental attention.
Right, well, we'll step inside just briefly if that's all right, Mr. Carter. Dean Carter. If we can come in, Mr. Carter, perhaps you could help us in your sister's absence.
Carter blinked and led them through an entrance hall that smelled faintly of damp and featured a brown and orange patterned carpet with peach artex walls. It was a three-story property, thanks to an attic extension, and the stairs led up directly from the lobby. He showed them into a large room on the left that seemed to serve as a communal lounge. There was a television on which a video game had been paused, a clutch of mismatched armchairs, and at the far end, a small bar with optics and a couple of stools. It reminded Helena of the B&B in Blackpool she'd go to with her parents as a kid to see the illuminations in the winter months. That place had held an air of excitement and possibility, she remembered. This house seemed shrouded in faint melancholy. How many rooms do you have here? She asked.
Six, all doubles and shared but one, Carter said, stuffing his hands into his pockets. We've got one spare, but it'll be snapped up before long. I thought that might be an inquiry when you rang the bell.
Brewster took out his phone.
Do you know this man, Mr. Carter?
Carter squinted at the photograph on the screen.
Oh, yeah, that's...
He clicked his fingers repeatedly.
That's... what's his name? Jakob, that's it. Your lot came round here ages ago asking after him.
We're looking at the case again, Helena said. What can you tell us about Jakob Jasinski?
I know he left without settling his bill, Carter said shortly. My sister was fuming about that, I can tell you. But I don't have much to do with the guests. Didn't bother me.
Any small detail you might remember could help, Helena said.
All I know is that he shared a room.
He looked up at the ceiling.
His roommate's still here, Pavel. He might be able to help you.
Brewster perked up.
Is he up there now?
Carter looked longingly at the TV.
I'm not sure. We don't keep tabs on him.
He tilted his chin and frowned.
He's second floor, first door on your left, room 2A. Go on up if you like.
They climbed the stairs, passing a small window on the right, the sill crammed full of chipped Royal Doulton ornaments, ladies in their finery.
The higher we go, the more it smells like cooked cabbage,
Brewster complained, earning himself a poke in the back from Helena. Brewster rapped on the door of room 2A. Helena heard a shuffling sound from within and thought the walls must be paper thin. When the door opened, a dishevelled man of around 60, thin and pale with an unshaven face, said simply,
"Yes?"
Brewster went through the introductions again, and Pavel invited them inside without hesitation. Helena braced herself, but the place was spotless. Worn and tired, certainly, but the window was open and the surfaces were uncluttered. The room was larger than she'd expected, but she still struggled to imagine living here day in, day out. Brewster explained that they were looking for information about Jakob Jasinski, and Pavel smiled sadly.
He was a nice boy, and I missed him when he went. We shared this room.
He pointed to a large, old-fashioned oak wardrobe against the far wall.
His bed used to be there, but when he left, Pat let me have the room to myself. This is the only room for a single person in the house, he said proudly. But I hope to move on soon myself. I am hoping for the right opportunity.
He paused, looking thoughtful.
Meanwhile, the time passes so quickly.
Helena said, Pavel, I know you've spoken to the police before, but we wondered if you could...
Me? No. Cops have not spoken to me before. Only Pat and that layabout brother of hers.
Helena looked at Brewster, who shook his head in disbelief. A man went missing, and officers didn't even speak to his roommate. It bordered on negligence. So, it's a while ago now, I know, but could you tell us anything you remember about Jakob? Anything he said to you that might give us a clue about what happened? Why he suddenly left without a word? Pavel walked over to the window and stood with his back to it, gripping onto the windowsill either side.
He had so many dreams and plans, like lots of young Polish men who come over here. Sadly, most of them find out very quickly that this is not quite the land of milk and honey they had hoped, no matter how hard one works.
Helena nodded.
And what were Jakub's plans?
The usual, Pavel sighed. To work hard, make his fortune. But he did not come from a place of greed. He wanted to regain his self-respect after a romantic disappointment back home. He dreamed of going back as a wealthy man to show her what she had missed.
I see, Helena said. Jakob's mother said that in the last communication she had with him, he told her he was happy in his work and he'd been stable there for a couple of years. Unfortunately, she didn't make a note of his workplace, as there'd been so many over time. Do you know where it was?
Sorry, he never mentioned the name of the place.
And where did Jakob say he was going when he